From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 3 years ago today, President Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States. Now, we're at the brink of the president's Senate impeachment trial, only the third time in history a president has faced trial in the Senate. The first time when a president faces re-election. There are many unknowns. How long will the trial last? Will there be any witness testimony? What will happen if any new evidence surfaces? And ultimately, what will the Senate decide? Plus, President Trump is still headed to Davos, and there is still a presidential election on the horizon. So this hour on Point, what to look for in the historic week ahead. And you can join us. What do you expect from the Senate trial as it gets going tomorrow? What witnesses do you want to hear from, if any? Will you be tuning in or watching? And if so, what will you be looking for? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And before we get going, I want to give a very special welcome to our newest listeners on 102.1 WMUK in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Michigan, you chose a historic week to join us here at On Point, so welcome to you all. We're really great to have you, really happy to have you in the On Point family. Well, let's get right to our panelists today who will help us understand this historic week in the news. And joining us from Washington is Doyle McManus. He's a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Doyle, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Meghna.
It's great to have you. Also with us is PBS NewsHour's Lisa Desjardins. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks, Meghna.
And Lisa, of course, covers the Capitol for the NewsHour. And also joining us as well is Meredith McGraw. She's White House correspondent for Politico. Meredith, welcome to you.
Hi there, Meghna.
Okay, so Lisa, let's start with you. What do we know, if anything, about how this Senate trial might kick off tomorrow?
We have an enormous amount of questions that are not fully answered yet. Just speaking with sources this morning, there are many Republican Senate leadership offices who still believe that we will see a plan come out of McConnell's office for 24 hours of opening arguments from each side. And that right now, the latest plan was for that to be split in two 12-hour sessions for each side. That means for very long days, and that those opening arguments would likely go well into the space where most Americans are asleep each night. Now, Democrats have large objections to that, and so do some moderate Republicans. So I also have confirmed with sources here at the Capitol that there are discussions. There is some pushback from other Republicans who think that that is not a fair process or is not the best process. So here we are the day before the trial is supposed to start, and it's not clear exactly what it will look like. We do know that tomorrow at 1 o'clock Eastern time is when sort of the substance of the trial will begin. And that's when senators will debate how to organize it. And these idea of timing, as well as the rules. Senator McConnell has said that he has the votes for that organizing resolution, but this question of timing may have mucked that up slightly. We'll see.
Okay. So, Lisa, since you have contacts there at the Capitol, let me just ask you a little further. I mean, I think there might be some confusion. I personally feel it about why we don't know yet. I mean, the trial starts tomorrow. What's Senator Mitch McConnell's strategy here? Like, why is this actually happening?
There are two ways of looking at it. One is the way I think you're looking at it, which is like a normal person. We should, you know, which is this is a major event. This is a rare historic event. This is something that should be planned for. And this is not rocket science. An organizing resolution is only a few pages long. There is no reason to not have this set and clear. However, Congress does not operate in
like normal
logical
people?
Fashion. No, it does not operate like normal people. And there are two things. One is that there are extreme political calculations and strategy in every move regarding this impeachment trial, including these logistics, which are important for both sides in terms of how they prepare their opening arguments. That's one answer. And then two, Meghna, the truth is, this is very common for Congress to, in the last certainly decade and a half, to release major legislation the night before it hits the floor. And we've seen this in the case of healthcare, many, many debates where Congress has just presented huge pages and pages of documents one day before they vote. And there has not been a good deal for either members of Congress or the public to consider it. Not very much time.
Right. Here's 400 pages on health care or on a tax bill that's got handwritten notes in the margin. Vote on it tomorrow or the third time only in the history of the United States that the president has faced trial in the Senate. Let's figure it out on the day of the trial. I mean, Meredith, what's your take on all this?
Well, I think we're all, of course, waiting to see what exactly will happen tomorrow in the Senate and what exactly those rules are going to be. I know the White House, the legal team has been working overtime to get all of their ducks in a row ahead of the upcoming trial. And part of that is preparing their sort of star-studded legal team that they have lined up. And then, of course, at some point later today, we'll be getting a trial brief from the White House. And in that, we should be able to understand a little bit more about what their potential legal argument might be when they go to argue for the president on the Senate floor.
Well, so what do you – I mean, given that you cover the White House, Meredith, I'm just wondering, is this last-minute scramble for even just the terms of what the trial is going to be tomorrow, is it good for the president?
From the White House perspective, they do feel awfully confident about things moving forward. You know, with a Republican-controlled Senate, I think there is sort of a feeling that the cake is already baked in a lot of ways. So for them, it's about presenting sort of the best argument that they can to the public. It's not just the 100 senators who are acting as jurors, but they also want to make a case to the millions of Americans about why they think the president should be acquitted of these articles.
Now, Doyle, this isn't your first impeachment rodeo. So how is it that you compare the process that we've seen unfolding so far to, you know, today and the uncertainty around the terms of the trial to, you know, the impeachment of President Clinton?
Well, Meghna, you're right. I did cover Bill Clinton's trial back in 1999. And believe it or not, I actually covered part of the Watergate hearings back in 1973, although I hasten to add that I was only a college student journalist.
I was going to say you were barely out of diapers,
so
Doyle.
I'm not 100 years old yet, but I am here as the ghost of impeachment's past. And how does this compare? Well, the lesson here really is that of course, we know that the issues are different from one impeachment to another, but the big difference here between this impeachment and both of those, but let's look at Clinton, which is the closest analogy, is that the structure of our parties is very different, and the two parties aren't speaking to each other. Mm-hmm. This battle over the rules and over the format of the trial and over the timing, will there be 12-hour sessions? It sounds dry as dust, but really what we are seeing here is something Meredith just mentioned, and that is this isn't just a trial. It's a television show. Mm-hmm. It's an infomercial in which each party, the partisans of the president and his opponents, are going to try and present their cases to the public. And Mitch McConnell wants that television show to be as boring as it can be, which is why he wants 12-hour sessions going until midnight, that no one will stay up for the whole thing. And it's also why the White House wants it to be as fast as can be. We know the president wants to get this done, if possible, before State of the Union in 2 weeks. So that's what's going on. But the contrast between the Clinton impeachment 21 years ago could not be starker. In that one, we knew what the rules were going to be because the two parties had gotten together. They had cut a deal well beforehand. And believe it or not, the resolution on what the rules of that trial were going to be passed by a vote of 100-0.
Huh. Wow. So there was at least some agreement about the duty of Congress towards good governance around impeachment proceedings. But Doyle, if I may, I want to play a couple of bits of tape from, you know, today's Congress that speak to, I think, the point you're making about how the parties are just talking past each other. So here is Illinois Senator Democrat Dick Durbin. He was on NBC's Meet the Press this weekend talking about the fairness or the need for fairness in the upcoming trial in the Senate.
the Senate itself is on trial, as far as I'm concerned, and the jury's the American people. The question is whether or not we are going to have a fair trial, whether the members of the Senate are going to be loyal to the Constitution or loyal to the president. A fair trial, everyone understands, involves evidence. Evidence would be documents and witnesses. We know the president has refused to provide documentation beyond the July 25th telephone memo, and he's refused to provide basic witnesses.
So that's Illinois Democrat Senator Dick Durbin. Here's Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday.
If the House isn't prepared to go forward with the evidence that they produced in the impeachment inquiry, maybe they ought to withdraw the articles of impeachment and start over again. This isn't the Senate's responsibility to make the case. This is the House's responsibility under the Constitution. And the Senate's supposed to decide the case sitting as a court of impeachment. So this is really on the House to make that decision.
That's Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas. So, Doyle, what are you hearing those two senators?
Well, as you say, we are hearing two parties describing this process in completely different ways. One of the things that was going on, incidentally, in the Clinton impeachment trial was that the Senate, as an institution on both sides, wanted to come through the process with some shred of bipartisanship and with some sense of honor. And they actually were thinking about the institutional needs of themselves rather than either Bill Clinton or the Republican Party. Mm. That's completely different now. And this is just really – we're hearing maximalist arguments on both sides. Dick Durbin, the Democrat, framing this as if you don't get lots of witnesses, it's not a fair trial. John Cornyn saying, well, the House blew it, so they should just go away. The arguments from the lawyers on both sides, from the managers from the House and from the White House counsel, were complete scorched earth arguments. There's no middle ground here.
Well, we are talking this hour about what to expect in the historic week ahead, as tomorrow President Trump's impeachment trial is set to begin in the Senate. I'm joined today by Doyle McManus, Lisa Desjardins, and Meredith McGraw, and we want to hear from you. What do you think is going to happen in the Senate tomorrow? Will you be watching, even if it's at 1 o'clock in the morning? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what to expect in the historic week ahead, as tomorrow in the Senate, the trial of President Donald Trump begins in the impeachment proceedings. I'm joined today by Meredith McGraw. She's White House correspondent for Politico. Lisa Desjardins joins us as well. She's Capitol Hill correspondent for PBS NewsHour. And Doyle McManus is with us. He's a columnist for The Los Angeles Times, who, as he said in his words, in this conversation serves as the ghosts of impeachment past. Now, in the segment before we took a break, we were talking also about how the president has hired some very high profile, made for TV lawyers, essentially, who have a lot of experience in impeachment proceedings. One of them is Ken Starr. You may know him from the Clinton impeachment. So here is Kenneth Starr in November of 1998 speaking to the Judiciary Committee about why President Bill Clinton should be impeached. Starr argued that the president made false statements under oath, coached witnesses to recount false information, and concealed evidence.
Those acts constitute a pattern of obstruction that is fundamentally inconsistent with the president's duty to faithfully execute the law.
Kenneth Starr in 1998. Well, in 1999, then-citizen Donald Trump was not a fan of Ken Starr. Here's what he said in an MSNBC interview.
I think Ken Starr is a lunatic. I really think that Ken Starr is a disaster. I hated the way the president handled it. It was a long and terrible process.
That's then-citizen Donald Trump in 1999. As president, he has hired Ken Starr to be on his defense team for the Senate trial. So Meredith McGraw, this seems like a – I was going to – does it seem like a smart move? Or like, what do you think of it?
Well, I think as is true with the clip you just played, it seems like with President Trump, there's always something in his past to reference some sort of criticism from the past. But, the White House really wanted to get a TV-ready legal team lined up. President Trump is, of course, acutely aware of the importance of visuals and the optics surrounding this trial. And when you have folks like Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz, Jay Sekulow, these are regulars on Fox News. These are regulars on cable. And they're hoping that they can artfully argue on television the president's case and perhaps do it with a little bit of a TV sizzle as well.
Yeah. Well, so, Lisa, I mean, to Meredith's point here, I mean, we can always look back and such are our times that there's a lot of media, documented media evidence about things that people have said in the past, and the president being inconsistent in his views is not news. But I do think that, you know, thinking about what Doyle said about what it was like back in 1999, in 2020, as we discuss impeachment, and we've discussed many times that it is fundamentally a political proceeding as well, perhaps the ultimate jury that matters, since we're in a re-election year, is the public. And the president's got a smart strategy here because there'll be minute-long clips autoplaying on Facebook, on Twitter, coming out of the trial over the next couple of days. And if you have people like Ken Starr, like Alan Dershowitz, who are very good at making arguments, pithy arguments that can really redound with the public, seems like a good strategy.
Well, you certainly can understand why he's made it. And I think going back to Doyle's point that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would like to make this as boring as possible. Anyone who has watched the 1999 Clinton impeachment opening arguments realize that's not hard to do. Like they're very dry to begin with. I will say, though, Alan Dershowitz is an interesting case because There may be somewhat of a risk there because I do think he is such an electric personality in this kind of venue. When he actually testified for President Clinton in one of the House hearings before it reached the Senate in 1998, that was. And he was really one of the most commanding witnesses. I watched all of that testimony and he was by far the most commanding and one who was really able to sell his points. He also is making an interesting argument. He's not defending the president so much on substance as he is on the idea of constitutionality, and that basically the idea that House Democrats have gone too far and that this is not within their power. So we'll see two debates, one over the merits of what the president did and what that means, and then the second over really what the House power is and what Senate power is. And I think we're going to see, I think Dershowitz will be someone whose clips will be played a lot. However, that's why Nancy Pelosi picked the manager she did. Many of these are some of the sort of star speakers from the House impeachment hearings.
Well, so let's listen to a little bit of what Alan Dershowitz has said in the past couple of days, to your point, Lisa. So here he is with ABC's George Stephanopoulos just yesterday about whether or not it's acceptable for a president to solicit foreign interference in an election. And here is what Alan Dershowitz said.
I'm a liberal Democrat who's been critical of many of the policies of the president. I'm here as a constitutional lawyer, a lawyer who's taught for 50 years constitutional a criminal procedure at Harvard, taught a course on impeachment, taught a course on constitutional litigation. I'm here to lend my expertise on that issue and that issue alone, because that's the primary issue.
So you don't think it's okay?
If the allegations are not impeachable, then this trial should result in an acquittal, regardless of whether the conduct is regarded as okay by you or by me or by voters.
What do
you
think?
That's an issue for the voters.
Alan Dershowitz on ABC just yesterday. Doyle McManus, to me, the real key line there is, if the allegations are not impeachable, then the trial should result in an acquittal. You know what I hear there? I hear a very, very smart defense lawyer reframing the argument in advance of a trial.
That's right. But that's always part of an impeachment trial because the standard for a conviction on impeachment, the standard for what an impeachable offense is always contested. We've had that argument for months on what an impeachable offense is. But I have to say that Alan Dershowitz is kind of an outlier, a bit of a dissident among constitutional scholars whom I've spent way too much time reading over the last few months, most of whom believe that abuse of power, which is the first charge the House is making here, is really the central danger that the framers had in mind when they wrote the impeachment clause into the Constitution in the first place. You can go back to Alexander Hamilton, who wrote a wonderful essay on impeachment, and he said, and I'm going to quote, quick quote here, he said the main danger they're guarding against here is, his quote is, the abuse or violation of a public trust. You're going to hear that phrase from the Democrats a lot. And when Alan Dershowitz says, well, I'm a Harvard professor, another Harvard professor, Lawrence Tribe, just wrote a long essay saying, my friend Alan Dershowitz is completely wrong about this. So we may have a battle of the Harvard professors.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, to the point that Alexander Hamilton was making a couple of centuries ago, he talked about that the crime of impeachment, there may not necessarily be a statutory crime committed, but it's a crime against the body politic of the nation, of crime against the United States. And that's why, while it may be political, it is a high crime. Right, Doyle? That's makes it the high crime.
That's right. Because the phrase in the Constitution is high crimes sounds to us like it means a crime. The argument is always made, and in fact, the president's lawyers have made this argument, that there's not a crime in this impeachment. There's not a violation of the criminal code. The president didn't shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, or he didn't steal a document, or divert money. But that's not what the framers meant when they put that phrase in the Constitution. By a high crime, they meant a crime against the constitutional political order.
Right. Although we also now know, as of last week, the Office of Management and Budget has decided that it was against the law for the White House to withhold that funding, that $400 million in funding from Ukraine. So we have that, too, just last week. But let's go to John, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. John, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Doing well. What's your thought?
Well, I'm a huge Democrat, and after this whole deal here, I definitely would be a Republican after this. That Nancy Pelosi I don't think she has enough work to do, and if she ain't doing stuff with the president, working together as a team, they should just get rid of her already. Our president, you got to support our president. Look at what he's done. Look at all our presidents, what they've done. But I think Trump's been amazing in there for everybody, jobs, and he's got good ideas. He's very smart, and everybody should be supporting him.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you so much for your call. Lisa Desjardins, what do you hear in John's comment?
Well, I think this is why one reason Nancy Pelosi was so reluctant for so long to engage with impeachment. And now every time she brings it up, she explains that she feels she had no choice because of what the president did on the Ukraine phone call. But as to your point earlier, Nancy Pelosi also says repeatedly that what matters the most is the public and public sentiment. She likes to quote an Abraham Lincoln quote about that. So that's a phone call that Democrats certainly don't want to hear, and they know it's a risk they're taking. But the truth is, when the tide shifted on this particular piece of impeachment, when Nancy Pelosi signed on to engage in this inquiry, it was something that they did because they felt the president had done something so abusive of power that they were not doing it for political reasons. They knew they were taking a political risk, and you heard that in this phone call.
Let's go to Kathy, who's calling from Binghamton, New York. Kathy, you're on the air.
Oh, hi there. Thank you for the show today, and happy Martin Luther King Day. I just wanted to say two comments. One is, it seems every time I hear any news site from any of the Republican senators and certainly the House of Representatives members, they have their talking points very clear, and they don't sway from them at all, which is they don't have a case. They don't say what their case is not. They just say they don't have a case. And they also tend to say you know, this is political. They say they're good at saying the same thing over and over. Whereas whenever I hear Schumer talk or Nancy Pelosi, they say pretty refined and detailed things that I imagine don't make great sound bites, do not make the impression of, okay, I can understand that. I can walk away with an opinion from that, because it's, you know, it's hard. I mean, it's detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And my second comment is, I remember the Bill Clinton impeachment trial and the publicity and everything. And as a Democrat, I remember feeling conflicted and not being, you know, oh, I'm all in with my party, I don't care what. And my friends were the same. We did do a lot. There was introspection. We tried to parse it and figure it out to see what was perhaps abusive and what wasn't. So I don't see, you know, it's a whole different ballgame this year.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for your call. So Meredith, bunch of things we could talk about in Kathy's comment there. But let me ask you, there are some senators, I'm thinking Mitt Romney, for example, who, I mean, could they play a bigger role in this in the trial starting tomorrow, because of it seems like they're not entirely in lockstep with the direction Mitch McConnell wants to go in?
Yeah, I think there's a small group of Republican senators who are moderates and who the Democrats have their eyes on as, you know, potential folks that they could have vote with them to potentially bring witnesses to the floor to call, you know, for additional evidence. And like you said, people like Mitt Romney, we think of folks like Senator Susan Collins or Senator Cory Gardner. People like that will be interesting to watch as we move forward this week.
Doyle, what do you think?
The other thing that Kathy said that is an interesting contrast is that, yes, in the Clinton impeachment, there were plenty of Democrats who said, we're very distressed at what our president did, and we want to show some disapproval of that. In fact, there was a long debate among Democrats at the time about whether Clinton should be censured. There was some of that at the beginning of this story, when President Trump stood on the lawn of the White House and said, yes, I want Ukraine to dig up dirt on Joe Biden, and I want China to dig up dirt on Joe Biden, too. There were any number of senators who said, Mr. President, you really shouldn't have done that. But since then, this White House and this president have been very effective at shutting down that kind of dissent. Meredith is right to list those senators, Romney, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is another one, who are genuinely distressed at what the president has done. But you don't hear an awful lot from them. They're lying pretty low.
Well, on the other hand, we have very vociferous defense from other Republicans here. But let's also just listen to another member of the president's legal defense team. This is Robert Ray. He spoke to NPR's Weekend Edition on Sunday. He succeeded Ken Starr as the head of the Office of Independent Counsel back in 1999 and negotiated a settlement with President Clinton after the conclusion of the trial that ended in the fine and the suspension of his law license. So here's Robert Ray on Sunday.
This is an impeachment that is a partisan effort. It does not enjoy bipartisan support. And for that reason, it is illegitimate. And as a consequence, principally because of the fact that no crimes were charged in the articles of impeachment, which is unprecedented.
Okay, so that's Robert Ray on NPR on Sunday. Lisa Desjardins, I mean, he's saying, he's making the assertion that because it's the impeachment proceedings do not have bipartisan support, therefore it's illegitimate. We have actually heard this before, but it's interesting now to hear one of the president's direct lawyers who will be defending him tomorrow saying that.
For both sides, I think we are going to hear a lot of arguments about motive, right? And the question is, were House Democrats, what is their motive? Is it political? Is it not? Same with the president. What was his motive for what he was doing with Ukraine? Was it political? Was it not? And the trouble, as any lawyer knows, with questions of motive, is they're very difficult to prove. You see what you want to see. And I think that's why we have seen very little change in how the American public looks at this. Generally, the country is split 47-47 or maybe 48-48 over whether this president should be removed. And that has not changed very much, if at all, since the House impeachment hearings began. And I think it is because it comes down to this question of motive, and that is hard to prove.
Meredith, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break. The president, as far as I understand, is still scheduled to go to Davos this week, right?
That's right. There were a lot of questions about whether or not he would end up going. Of course, he canceled at the last minute last year. He did not go. But he is going to be making his way across the Atlantic. He'll be speaking there and holding a lot of bilateral meetings while all this is going on.
Being on the international stage, and his supporters would say doing the job of the president of the United States. So we are talking about what to look for in this historic week ahead. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Xinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what to expect in this historic week ahead as tomorrow, the trial of the President of the United States is set to begin in the Senate. I'm joined today by Meredith McGraw. She's White House correspondent for Politico. Lisa Desjardins is also with us. She's Capitol Hill correspondent for PBS's NewsHour. And Doyle McManus joins us. He's a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And let's go to our callers. Let's go to James, who's calling from New London, Connecticut. James, you're on the air.
I have both a comment and a question. My comment is very simply that the American people deserve to hear from all potential witnesses, not only to facilitate a fair trial, but also to allow us to hold our senators accountable for their actions in the impeachment process. My question is, how are the senators who have publicly claimed that they are not impartial and have already decided their vote, after taking the oath to be impartial, how are they not being charged with perjury?
James, thank you for that call. And Lisa, James noting that the senators last week had to raise their hands and say they would do impartial justice.
I think the answer to that is if you watch their wording, they're being very careful on air. They're saying, I don't think what the House presented during its hearings was convincing, but I will listen now. I think he raises a larger point, though, that it is unclear that there are anyone who's really changing their mind from their party. There are those voters you've been talking about, those senators in the middle, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, who are considered people who perhaps their vote could go either way. But I think to answer his question about, I asked one of the Senate Republican leaders, John Barrasso, about this last week. How can you say you're impartial when you're coordinating with the White House? And he said, well, we are. Their answer to that is, we just are impartial. So it's a question without an answer. And I think they are watching their wording very carefully.
I'm pausing here for a second because that's kind of amazing. Lisa. I mean, doesn't it strike at the very heart of how we presume justice and governance ought to work in this country?
Well, there's a conflict here. That's right, that they are taking an oath to be impartial. That is part of a justice system. That is part of a trial. However, this is a unique trial in that it is being held by the most partisan people in the country on both sides. You know, so as we're holding Republican feet to the fire, are we asking Democrats, what about Chuck Schumer, who clearly is coordinating with the House managers? You know, so it is a political process sort of with this mask of impartiality. Those two things do not mesh. And it's right for us to be asking those questions. But it is an inherent conflict in how our founding fathers compromised over impeachment. They admitted they didn't really have this figured out. This was a difficult thing for them to sort out. This process is not perfect, and I think the founding fathers would admit that.
Right. So perhaps then just the plain spoken truth about what Senate decorum or procedural decorum in impeachment's past sort of papered over. Meredith, what do you think?
Well, I was so struck by the caller's comments about wanting to hear from the witnesses. Over the course of, the past few weeks, a lot of new evidence has emerged. There's, of course, the documents that Giuliani's associate turned over, Lev Parnas. As you mentioned earlier, the watchdog agency saying that the actions by the OMB were illegal. So there are a lot of new questions that have been raised. And I think a lot of people, the public is looking, like you said, to hear from some of these new voices that have recently emerged.
And Meredith, by the way, thank you for clarifying that, because I got my alphabet soup of acronyms mixed up before the break. It was the General Accounting Office, right, that found that the OMB's actions regarding Ukraine were against the law. So thank you for that clarification.
Yes. The federal government and all of the, short three-letter, acronyms. No, you got it.
Okay. So let's go to Lou, who's calling from Amherst, Massachusetts. Lou, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello. You put me right on the spot to push a little further on the government accountant's office and the fact that we have new evidence about how the money was suspended, who was responsible, and I'd like to hear that. I come from an Eastern Bloc country. I immigrated here over 40 years ago. I've loved democracy and the Constitution and follow the process. I pay 30% of my taxes. I want to know how my money is spent and whether it's spent in the correct way. The power of the purse belongs to Congress. If Congress is being thwarted principally for political reasons on the part of the executive office, we should understand that in full.
Well, Lou, thank you for your call. And Lisa, let me turn to you on that. You can go ahead and answer Lou's question directly if you want, but it also makes me wonder, there is this bigger question of what will happen if and when any new evidence percolates over the next week, because that with Lev Parnas's revelations from last week, that's already a question in the air.
That's right. This is why this organizing or starting resolution tomorrow could be very important. It will set sort of the opening arguments, but it also will potentially set a vote on whether to have witnesses or not. We expect that to be in the organizing resolution. And then after we get through this opening piece, the arguments, and then perhaps a motion to dismiss the case altogether, after that is when the Senate will debate witnesses and potentially any new evidence that has come up in between the House managers making their arguments and whatever period that is, next week. And that could be a very difficult debate. And it could be also be very unsatisfying for the American public, because senators are not permitted to speak during this trial. Any deliberation has to happen behind closed doors. So if there's deliberation over these ideas right now, that's going to happen behind closed doors. The voting will be public. How they vote, we will see. What they think, we will not hear.
Well, let's go to Aaron, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Great show and a good group of guests. However, I have to take exception with something that Mr. McManus said at the very beginning, and that is he described the Democrats and the Republicans as making statements in advance of this, and he described both of their sets of statements as scorched earth. The problem with that is I've been paying attention to all of this, too. And while the Democrats seem to be laying out legal arguments and pointing out facts that are irrefutable at this point, The Republicans are not doing the same thing. They are just lobbing grenades, it seems like. And by describing both sides as scorched earth, I think it's you're kind of saying, well, both sides do it. And I think the media does a disservice to the American electorate when they describe it as, well, both sides are guilty, because what we end up doing is saying, well, then I can't pay attention. We throw our hands up and the bad guys or somebody gets away with what they were trying to get away with. We need to pay attention, and we need the media not to simply say, well, everybody's guilty. I think the media needs to be more analytical and point out when, you know, one side is actually trying to do what's right.
Mm. Aaron, thank you so much for that call, and your point is well taken. Doyle, would you like to respond to him?
Sure. I think Aaron's point is well taken, and I do feel constrained to point out that I certainly didn't say that everybody's guilty, and I did not mean to imply a false equivalence. But here's where I find some maximalist arguments on both sides, which incidentally is not that unusual in either a trial or an impeachment. The Republicans, of course, are being maximalist by saying there is nothing here that was improper. There are no impeachable offenses at all. And the whole House proceeding was illegitimate and even in the weirdest distortion of the law, unconstitutional. The Democrats took an interesting step, I thought, in their brief. They didn't merely say that the president had abused his powers, and they didn't merely say that he had overstepped the law, but they said that the president must be removed from office because he is a danger to the national security. I thought that was a pretty tough swipe to take, and it's obviously within their rights to do it, but that was not an appeal to the center.
Mm. So, Doyle, let's take a step back for a second here, because even in this media-saturated world that we're living in, I keep coming back to the fact that we have arrived at a moment that has only happened, until tomorrow, two other times in the history of the United States. So no matter what we think about it, no matter if we're just exhausted by partisanship, if we've had it up to our ears in the acrimony coming out of Washington, if we just like got to turn off the cable TV news because it's wall-to-wall politics, I get it. Like, it's exhausting in America right now. But on the other hand, something big is going to happen in America tomorrow in the chamber of the United States Senate. Shouldn't we as a nation also like kind of take stock of that what is happening in the trial is essentially some kind of demonstration of what we as a nation should have regarding our expectations for the highest office in the land, for the presidency of the United States?
Yes, absolutely. And to put myself, I suspect, on Aaron's side in this dispute, I think if the Senate accepts the president's argument that nothing in those charges constitutes an impeachable offense. In other words, not the question of whether he did it or not, but even if he did it, you can't impeach on those grounds. I'm afraid the Senate will be establishing the principle that there is no such thing as an impeachable offense, that it's impossible to imagine anything that would be impeachable, because the Republicans have essentially advanced the theory that a president can do anything he wants to do. And that's why I think this will go beyond, at least in the minds of some senators, like those we've mentioned, this will go beyond the politics of the moment. Those senators are going to be very conscious that what they do over the next two or three or 4 weeks is going to go into their obituaries, is going to be part of their mark on history and on the Constitution.
Their obituaries, their mark on history, and even in the closer future, an election year. So, Meredith, let me just turn to you here quickly. I mean, we should also know this is the first time an impeachment has happened as a president is running for re-election as well. That is uniquely different than what happened with President Clinton, for example.
Right. We'll see, you know, come November, what sort of impact, of course, this has for anybody, you know, running for office. And of course, for President Trump running for re-election, his campaign has tried to capitalize on all of this. They've fundraised off of impeachment in general. And some Republicans think that this is somehow
politically good for the president. They say, you know, this is what happens when he comes to Washington and he shakes things up. So we'll see. But it is particularly fascinating that this is all happening at such an electrifying moment in American politics in such a divided time, too.
Yeah. And so, Lisa, we also have, just to note, we have four senators who will be off the campaign trail for the duration of the trial, right?
That's right. It couldn't be worse timing for them, especially Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, who really are being closely watched in Iowa, and how well they do in Iowa could have a massive impact on how far they can go and whether they could claim the nomination. It's got to be an incredibly tough week for them, and maybe even a tough day. I know many of them are chartering planes so that they expect the trial to end perhaps at 6 o'clock at night. Bernie Sanders has scheduled some 8 p.m. events local time in Des Moines. But if we get 12-hour sessions each day, that's going to impact whether they can make those events or not. And one thing they might be thinking about or not, how's this for irony? Today, we are 1 year away from the inauguration of the next term of a U.S. president. And here we are with so many questions about the current president and those who would like to take his job.
Yeah. And so on that point, even as we're focused on the trial, there are also still other issues bubbling up in Washington. For example, we're hearing from members of Congress, notably Representative Adam Schiff, about concerns that the intelligence agencies are withholding documents from congressional investigators. So I just want to play a moment here. This is Representative Schiff on ABC's This Week talking about those concerns. Namely, because some of those documents he believes, Schiff believes, could shed more light on the impeachment investigation.
The intelligence community is reluctant to have an open hearing, something that we had done every year prior to the Trump administration, because they're worried about angering the president. Well, part of their job is to speak truth to power.
So Meredith McGraw, Politico's been on top of this story. What is Schiff talking about?
Well, when he's saying that he's concerned, I think, you know, we should, I would say, I think we all should be concerned if the government is withholding anything from, you know, if they are withholding anything, you know, for whatever reasons. But it does speak to sort of these underlying questions about what we still don't know about the case in general.
And so Schiff there saying that we have members of the intelligence community say they don't want to testify in an open trial, and that the NSA may be withholding some documents under pressure, according to Schiff, from the White House. Lisa, do you have a quick thought on that?
Right. I think that we do have to watch this closely. And I think one of the greatest victims of partisanship in the last 2 years has been in work on intelligence. The intelligence committees in the Capitol used to be the most bipartisan. Now the House Intelligence Committee is the most partisan. It is a minefield for even those of our best Americans who can handle intellectual minefields, the intelligence community. It's very difficult for them to figure out how to pursue this. But obviously, congressional oversight is key, and they want access to these documents so that they can determine whether our president is acting corruptly or not.
Well, Doyle McManus, we have about 40 seconds left here in the show today. So I'm just wondering, come tomorrow, what are you going to be looking for at the start of the trial?
Wow. I'm going to be looking for two things. Number one, the obviously on the high end, an enormous, momentous debate over the Constitution and what impeachment means and what impeachability is. But then, as we've talked, the real drama here is going to be the fight over witnesses and whether anyone in the Republican side of the Senate is going to break from the president. So we're going to be all have our eyes on four or five or six Republican senators to see if there are any voices of dissent out there.
Well, Doyle McManus, columnist for the Los Angeles Times, thank you so much for being with us, Doyle.
Thank you.
And Lisa Desjardins, Capitol Hill correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Lisa, thank you as always.
Great show. You're welcome.
And Meredith McGraw, White House correspondent for Politico. It was great to have you, Meredith. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.